තෙරුවන් සරණයි. Okay, Therwan Sarnai, and welcome to all our listeners from around the world who are joining us as usual to listen to this English sermon. The purpose of these programs, as we all know, is to help our listeners, beings all over the world, get access to the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, so that they may find the happiness that we've all been looking for in our lives. Happiness which has always been evasive, happiness which we've always been chasing but never have been able to grab hold of. So when we begin to understand that such happiness is available to us when we actually stop chasing after it and realize that happiness actually exists within us, then the more we begin to experience that, the more we begin to rejoice in that, the more we feel that this is something that needs to be shared with all beings, with all human beings, and devas and brahmas and anyone really that may be able to experience the same joy and happiness. Obviously, this joy and happiness is very distant, very different from the materialistic pleasures of life that most people will be used to. It's an entirely different thinking, it's an entirely different experience. This is the joy of letting go. It's the joy of realizing that what made me unhappy was in fact all the things that I grew up and I learned and everyone told me was the things that made me happy. Once you realize that, you begin to let go. And that doesn't happen overnight. Sometimes it takes days and weeks and months and sometimes perhaps even years, and maybe even a lifetime for some people. But the little that we let go brings us happiness in equal amounts. And therefore, once you've experienced that, we're naturally inclined to let go even more every day, every week, every month, every year, and so on. So, as we experience this supreme bliss of Nibbana, this is why we call it the supreme bliss of Nibbana, such bliss and such happiness cannot be experienced elsewhere through other means, by doing other things and by chasing after happiness. This supreme bliss of Nibbana has only been open to us and available to us since the Gautama Samma Sambuddha, the Gautama Lord Buddha, attained enlightenment. This path to happiness, this path to liberation, emancipation, arose in his mind under the Bodhi tree, when after having spent eons, which is a very long, long period of time, trying to realize the path to deathlessness, the path to stop decaying, the path to stop old age and illness. He then expounded this Dhamma, he disseminated this Dhamma to all beings, to redeem all beings from the clutches of samsara, to redeem all beings from the pain and suffering of attachment and ignorance. So before we commence the Dhamma sermon, this is why we always pay our respects to the perfect one, the peerless one, the unequaled one, the Gautama Samma Sambuddha. So as I recite this stanza in respect of his uncalculable, unamountable, unimaginable, unquantifiable qualities, join me in doing so. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Let us all also take a moment to invite the devas and brahmas, spirits, demons, our distant and past relations, the dead, who we may have come across at some point in sansara, and we will definitely have come across in sansara. Let us not forget the times when the Lord Buddha has reminded us that from the tiniest insect, from an ant, to perhaps the dolphins and blue whales that swim the ocean, elephants and cockroaches and flies and mosquitoes, and everything and every animal in between, big or small, whatever, no matter the size, we've all been connected in one way or the other. They have all been our brothers and our sisters, our fathers, our mothers, our cousins, our teachers. And therefore, not just the beings that are alive today, but also beings who are alive as human beings, but also beings who are not fortunate enough to be born in the blissful plane as either humans and devas and brahmas, there will also be others who are born in the pereta worlds as spirits and demons. Perhaps they might have committed some sins which are responsible for their birth in the woeful plane today, and unfortunately, having been born there, they are unable to understand the Dhamma because they do not possess the faculty of wisdom or prajna. However, when they realize the errors of their ways, they understand and come to their senses and come along and at least witness these meritorious deeds and rejoice in the merits that we all acquire. So let us all invite the devas, the brahmas, spirits and demons and the dead, our past relations, who, as I have just said, might have been our brothers, our sisters, our mothers and fathers and teachers and so on. May they all be able to join us from wherever they are. May they all be able to listen to us from wherever they are. And anyone who is keen to listen to the Lord Buddha's teaching, anyone who is looking to escape from the clutches of sansara, may they receive this Dhamma just as you and I have been able to do so. May the Dhamma help them all cross the ocean of sansara. May they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So as I make this invitation, please join me in extending this invitation out to all of those beings, and in your hearts and minds, invite them all to listen to this Dhamma sermon. Samanta chakvalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajasans sunantu sakamokkadam. Dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta. Dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta. ධම්ම සවන කාලෝ අයං බදන්තා. Okay, let us all also take a brief moment to reflect on the fact that despite you and I being disciples of the Buddha today and being able to listen to this Dhamma and follow the path to supreme happiness and enlightenment, the majority of time that we have spent in samsara has been without recourse to any kind of Dhamma. We have not had the opportunity to associate with noble associates, noble people, the Kalyana Mitras. And having not been able to do so, our associates and our friends have always only been evil people, bad people, ignoble people, who have often persuaded us, enticed us to take part in wrongdoings through mind, speech and body. And having done so, we may have insulted, not may have, we almost certainly have, insulted Aryas, they are the noble people, by using harsh words and slander. And having not been able to identify the Kalyana Mitras, the noble associates, having not been able to identify Samma Sambuddhas, Paccheka Buddhas, Arahatta Buddhas, the Anagami ones and the Sakurdagami ones and the Sotapanna ones and any Aryas for that matter, we may have not even bothered to look their way. We may have often walked away from them when having had the chance to sit down, be in their vicinity and listen to their Dhamma and be the recipients of their kindness and generosity. So oftentimes we will have missed that opportunity, and oftentimes we will have been very unkind and ungenerous to them. And then today when we try and attempt to understand the Dhamma, to listen to the Dhamma, it becomes an arduous task, it becomes a very difficult task, because the karmic energy that we would have released into the universe in having had those evil thoughts now come to block our path and our path to enlightenment and wisdom. So the only thing we can do right now is actually ask and seek for their forgiveness. The nature of noble people, of the Aryas, is such that no matter what harm we've done to them, no matter how much we've been unkind and cruel to them, they only look for ways and opportunities to forgive us and to help us find the path to liberation and wisdom and happiness. So just like when a child goes back home despite of what they've done, no matter what kind of heinous crimes they've done, they go back to their mother and in the warmth of her arms asks for her forgiveness, asks for her kindness and asks for her generosity. Just the same, the Aryas are no different. No matter what we've done, when we go back and ask for their forgiveness, ask for them to be kind to us and ask for them to redeem us from the errors that we've done, the wrongdoing that we've done to them, they shall do none other than forgive us. And therefore, let us take a moment to seek their forgiveness. So in your hearts and minds, take a moment to seek their forgiveness and make a firm determination that through the course of this Dhamma sermon, may the energy that the Aryas would have released into this universe help us all attain the noble fruits of Sotapanna, Sakurdagami, Anagami and Arihat. May we all be able to reflect on this Dhamma, bear this Dhamma and practice this Dhamma, apply Yoniso Manasikara and be able to eradicate raga, dvesha, moha, desire, aversion and delusion from our minds and be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Okay. As you know, unfortunately, we were delayed today again by about 45 minutes. We had some technical issues last week and I think the week before that as well. But I believe the sermons that were recorded have been made available to you through Skype and perhaps other methods. If you haven't not been able to access them, then please do let us know. And we will make all efforts to make them available. Technical issues can sometimes be in the shape of internet connectivity, which we are still struggling at the monastery. So, of course, we have to rely on our patrons to provide us with transport to travel to other locations. But, you know, it doesn't matter what it is that we have to do. Doesn't matter how far we'll have to go, doesn't matter what efforts we have to make. The sermons will go on for as long as there are people who are looking for these sermons, for as long as there are people who feel the need for these sermons. Because we do understand and appreciate that there are many millions of people around the world to whom Sinhala is a foreign language and a language in which they are not able to receive and understand the Dhamma, and English being the international language of communication, we do try and we promise to try and make every effort possible to make these sermons available as widely as possible and as soon as possible and as soon as they're available. So those efforts will continue. The reason we were delayed today was actually because we had a gentleman who visited us at the monastery and expressed an interest to ordain and come and spend some time, even at least, as an anagarika at the monastery. So these stories are becoming more and more popular, and we get people, both male and female, visit us at the monastery quite a lot now. Having been established for about almost 6 months now, since we first went into the monastery, we now home about almost 40 monks of all ages between 7 and late 50s, I think, is probably the, or even 60s. And we continue to grow in numbers. Even at this point, we have about a dozen young men and children who are looking to ordain, and that will only continue. The number will only continue to rise. The reason for this is because obviously, when the problem becomes clear, the solution becomes obvious, which I have stated many times in the past. I remember, I think in a previous sermon we discussed about two sheets of paper. I'll give you one sheet of paper which has several random numbers written on it. 2, 4, 6, 7, 9. I ask you a question. I ask you, does anyone know those numbers look special, look particularly interesting? And you tell me, no, they're all the same. At which point I give you a second sheet of paper. And now you read that paper, and on which is written the formula 3 plus 3 equals, which of course you know the answer to, which is 6. Now you look at the first sheet of paper and one answer, one number there looks particularly interesting. 2, 4, 7 and 9 don't look all that interesting, but 6 looks very interesting. This is because the question or the problem is now obvious to you. So for as long as and until the problem becomes obvious, it doesn't matter whether we come and slap you in the face with the answer or show it to you 24/7, 365 days a year, ask you to read books or listen to sermons, meditate or do whatever it is that you think Buddhists all around the world do. It doesn't matter what you keep doing. If the problem is not clear to you, then the answer is just another number, is just another word, is just another phrase, is just another thing to do. This is why the problem needs to be crystal clear. And this is why when the Buddha began to preach his teaching and his understanding of the Dhamma, he started with Dukkha Arya Satya. The first noble truth is not the cessation of suffering or the path to cessation of suffering. It is suffering in itself, the noble truth of suffering, and the cause for the noble truth of suffering. He starts with the problem. The problem must be absolutely clear. And when the first noble truth is clear, is crystal clear, the second noble truth is perfectly clear as well. And when that is clear, then the answer to which is the cessation of suffering becomes obvious, and the path to that becomes obvious as well. And this is the teaching that the Buddha has given himself. He says, if one understands the first noble truth, then through that knowledge, he begins to understand the second, third and fourth noble truths. So, this is why oftentimes we spend the time that we have during these sermons trying to explain to our listeners what the actual problem is, because there are plenty of sermons out there on the internet, there are books to read, there are meditation programs and classes you can attend, and what we find is that they're all talking about the answer. It's as if you remember from your school days, there will have been books and exercise books which you would have bought and used to practice sums. No one brings a book home and turn to the last page, and obviously you've got a whole lot of answers. None of those answers mean anything. It's meaningless. But when you look at the problem alone without the answer has meaning. It's a problem you need to solve, it's a problem you need to understand. Then you begin to work through the problem, and now if you can't work it out yourself, obviously you turn back into the pages, and some of these books I remember used to have steps to get you to the answer. Rather than give you the answer straight away, they give you the steps you need to work through the answer. This is what associating with noble friends is. It's exactly the same principle. If you realized, if you understood what the problem is, or at least you're trying to understand what the problem is, and perhaps not having done so entirely just yet, then you go and listen to and you speak with and you associate with people who can help you get there. These are the noble friends, these are the noble people, the Kalyanamitras. At one point, Venerable Ananda approaches the Lord Buddha and says, "Venerable Sir, according to my understanding, I believe half of your ministry here is the Buddha Shasane, half of your ministry is alive and prevails because of noble people, noble associates. Is that true, sir?" To which the Lord Buddha replies, "Ananda, you're mistaken. You're very much mistaken. Not half, but the entirety of my ministry prevails because of noble associates. For as long as noble people continue to prevail, for as long as my Dhamma and the discipline, Dharma and Vinaya, continue to flourish and prevail in the world, there will always be Sotapannas, Sakurdagamis, Anagamis and Arihats." And this is why we should all realize that this day and time that we live in, this era that we live in, is a very unique opportunity for all of us. Oftentimes when we've come into this world as human beings or devas or brahmas, we've come at times when we have not had the Dharma and Vinaya. We've not had the Dhamma and the discipline. And as a result, we've not had the opportunity to associate with Sotapannas, Sakurdagamis, Anagamis and Arihats. And what has that done to us? Well, all that's done to us is either it has influenced us and persuaded us to commit sins, unmeritorious deeds, which the consequences of which have led us to lives in the hells, either as pretas or animals or as asuras or in the hells with unimaginable suffering, the infernos. We've either spent many eons at a time there, or we have just continued to be born in the blissful plane, such as by doing meritorious deeds and having been born as humans and devas and brahmas, but never really finding the true liberation from samsara. What we need to remind ourselves day in, day out, and we should do this every single day that we wake up, every single day of the year, every single day of your lives, what you should do is wake up in the morning and ask yourselves, how fortunate am I to be born today in this era where we have the Dharma and the Vinaya? Without this, I have spent many times, many incalculable, uncountable times being born as humans. Without the Dharma and Vinaya, I have spent many eons at a time having been born a Deva, having been born a Brahma. But to what gain? Having been born as Devas and Brahmas, what do I have left today? I spent very long periods of time enjoying in the sensual pleasures, having anything and everything that I could demand at my fingertips. At the mere wish, a whim and a fancy was all that was required, and everything I wanted just appeared in front of me. But yet, today I'm born a human being. Today I look around, I just open my eyes and look around, and I can see animals who suffer tremendously. I know of the Deva, I know of the Pretas, I know of the Asuras, and I know of the hells, the infernos, where beings suffer continuously, perpetually, being born continuously in those worlds for many, many, many eons. And yet all of those beings would have had the opportunity to cycle in the Deva worlds and the Brahma worlds, and yet what have they attained? What have they achieved? You've got to ask yourself this question. If every morning you wake up, you work really hard, and at the end of the day you're told, well, actually, nothing that you've done today is of any value, you're not going to benefit from it, your friends, your family are not going to benefit from it, the world's not going to benefit from it, not one modicum, not one inch, not one zilch, no one's going to benefit from this. I don't think it's going to take long before you realize, well, I should probably start doing something else, I should be doing something different. Today, as I was coming into Ahaliyagoda, which is where we are right now, and at the Torunakoda Pushparame, from where we are streaming this sermon, the drive from the monastery to this place is about 30 kilometers. I counted the number of obituary notices that I came past. For those very young listeners who might not know what an obituary notice is, it's a notice that is put outside for the public to view when someone has died or passed away. And what I realized is, for the 30 kilometers that we came past, I think we came past at least 10 odd obituary notices. That's one for every 3 kilometers. All of these people are now dead. These people may have been your friends, might have been your families, someone in your family, your fathers, your brothers. And if they're not, well, they're almost certainly someone's brother. They're certainly someone's sister, someone's aunt or uncle, someone's cousin, someone's father or mother, someone's grandfather, someone's grandmother, someone's relation. The only difference is, perhaps they're not yours. Well, not yet. One day they're going to be yours. One day you're going to have to put up an obituary notice, or someone is going to have to put up your obituary notice. It's just a matter of time. No one needs to doubt that day is coming for all of us. Well, if you think differently, then sorry to say, but you're deeply mistaken. You've not yet realized that the deepest pain of loss is yet to come. The deepest kind of sorrow, the deepest kind of grief is yet to come. wake up every morning and do what I just said, and then look around you, the people at home, your mother, your father, the people you live with, your closest family, your loved ones. Can you imagine their face on an obituary notice? Can you picture it? On the top of it will say Anicca Vata Sankara, the meaning of which we discussed in one of the sermons in the past, and if you missed that, then I encourage you to listen to it. And below that will be the date of their birth, the date that they've died. In the center will be a picture of their face. On the bottom of it will be the details of how one can attend the funeral. Now, if that day is coming to all of us, and there's no doubt about that, well, why wait? You might as well go and prepare your obituary notice already. Just leave in fact, there's only one bit of information that you're uncertain of. Everything else is predetermined, is it not? The sentence on the top, Anicca Vata Sankara, well, there's no change there. The date of birth, well, all you got to do is just look at your birth certificate. It's got it printed in black and white. Where your funeral is going to be held, most families have a family funeral or a crematorium, and you can get the details from your parents or your grandparents. In fact, everyone will have had someone in your family pass away. If you don't know about this, then by all means go and speak to your parents, go and speak to your relations. Ask them about the last person that passed away in your family. Where were they buried? Just get that address, just get the place where they were buried and put that on your obituary. And you might as well just take a picture, get a selfie. And, you know, in this day and age, selfies are, there's plenty of them. This is what people do all day round. Go to places that they like, take selfies. Sometimes it becomes so annoying to other people. So, get yourself a selfie, prepare your obituary notice, and just leave one bit of detail blank. What bit of detail is that? Your date of death. That also is one point that you need to reflect on. You see, if you now prepare that obituary notice, and in fact, here's what you should do. Before you do yours, do one up for someone in your family. Someone you think is not going to be around in 10 years' time. Now, you're probably thinking, no, well, all my family is going to be around then. Well, actually, think again. If natural death is on its way, I'm sure there'll be someone who's closer to death than somebody else. Well, if it's not you, then obviously if your parents are still alive, it's going to be them. If they're still in their middle age, then it's your grandparents if they're still alive. And I'm only talking about natural death here. Natural death by aging and then going to death. I'm not talking about accidents. I'm not talking about diseases. I'm not talking about sudden death. I'm talking about natural death. Because if it's sudden death, well, you could be first to go. Do one up for someone in your family and then take it to them. Just tell them, hey, granddad, mom, dad, uncle, aunt, cousin, I've got something to show you. Well, you know, the last thing they're going to expect is their obituary notice. Just take it in a file so that they can't see what's inside until you open it up. And then you ask them, are you ready for this? You tell them, this is something that you'll want me to prepare for you one day. And they'll think, oh, well, my birthday is coming just around the corner. And they might even say, oh, no, don't spoil it. Don't spoil the surprise. They're probably thinking in their minds, oh, he's got a birthday card for me. Or she's got my birthday card ready. So give them the element of surprise. Let them be happy for that one moment. That's okay. Because that's what life is all about. Happy for one moment, not knowing the next moment. Once you've done that, and they're sat down and perhaps even place a glass of water next to them, because you might need to revive them by sprinkling some water on their face. And once you've done that, open the file up and or this folder and let them have a a good long look at this obituary notice. Let them look at their face in there. Let them look at the time of their birth. And then all you've got to do is look at their facial expressions. Look at how their eyes start to grow large. Look at their eyebrows. Look at their forehead. Look at the wrinkles on their face and how it turns from a smile or a grin to a frown. Look at how they are struggling to accept this shock, the shock of death, the shock that you are prepared for their death. Unfortunately, this is the thing that we're all afraid of. This is the thing that they're all thinking is never going to come to them. But we've got to remind ourselves, this day is coming. And I bet you there will obviously be at least one or two of them who, the moment you do this to them, they're going to shout at you. They're going to say, how dare you do something like that? How could you come up to me? How could you walk up to me and tell me that and show me my obituary notice? To which you've only got to ask one question. Are you sure you're not going to need one of these one day? Wait for their answer. Wait for them to answer. Let them think. Let them reflect on the life that they've had. Let them reflect on all those friends and family and relations that they've had to say goodbye to. And then it'll dawn on them, well, actually, what you've done is completely innocent. In fact, what you've brought to them is a gift. It's a gift because it's a reminder. It's a reminder for them that that day is coming. As we all know, that day is most certainly coming. The only bit of detail that we don't know is what the expiry date is for each of us. We don't have it etched on our shoulders or our foreheads or our hands or our arms or anywhere else. Because when Mara is ready, he comes and takes us. We can't say, no, I can't come with you. We can't say, it's not my time yet. We can't say, hey, not today, come back tomorrow, please. There's no time to, you don't get an opportunity to discuss. There's no round table discussion which you sit around and discuss when it's my time to go. When he says it's time to go, it's time to go. So that day is coming. And this is what I reflected on as I drove, or as we were driven from the monastery to where we are right now. And the fact is, for every 10 kilometers, there was about 3 of them as an average. So, but reality is, you look at an obituary notice and people tell themselves, oh, how sad, how sorry. I feel so sorry for that young man. He should have lived a bit longer. How many hopes he might have had. What about his family? Oh, I feel so sorry for him. My deepest condolences, my deepest sympathies. And yet you ask them, hey, I've got a copy of your obituary, are you ready for it? And that gives them the shock of their life. Decay, death, old age, disease, these things are coming. It's like a storm that is about to hit. Some of you may live in countries where you're often prone to strong and harsh weather conditions. You might have hailstorms, you might have strong winds and maybe even tsunamis. And sometimes people are keen to watch the weather channel. They watch the weather channel because you're wanting to know what's up ahead. You're wanting to know whether there's going to be hailstorms or strong gales and strong winds. Why? Because you want to protect yourself. You want to protect yourself from harm. You want to protect your families and your property. Well, the sad reality is people are so keen to do this for their family, for their property, and for themselves, the themselves that they can see in the mirror. But what about the tsunami of death that's coming? What about the tsunami of old age that's coming? What about the tsunami of disease and decay that's coming? There's no doubt that these four are on its way. You might watch the weather channel and go, actually, the weather's okay for the next fortnight. It's okay for the next couple of weeks. Nothing we need to worry about. But what channel can you watch where they're going to say, you're okay for the next fortnight? Which channel on TV tells you that you're not going to fall ill for the next 2 weeks? Which channel is going to tell you you're not going to die in the next 2 weeks? Which channel is going to tell you you're not going to decay in the next 2 weeks? Well, every channel you can think of, and I'm talking about the channels that you should be watching, these are the channels of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. If you watch these channels, death is everywhere. The philosophy and the teaching of death is inevitable, and death is just around the corner, disease is just around the corner, decay and illness is just around the corner, is broadcast 24/7, 365 days a year. But because we don't like to listen to this kind of news, we switch the channel off. People sometimes don't even go to the temple. People don't go and talk to a monk because they're scared, they're worried. I don't want to hear things that I don't like to hear. Well, whether you like to hear it or not, when the tsunami is coming, the tsunami is going to come and it's going to hit you and it's going to take everything that belongs to you. This is the reality of life. And this is what we need to prepare for. Because when that day comes, not if that day comes, when that day comes, you're going to go. When that day comes, someone's going to pick up that obituary that you prepared with your name on it, with your date of birth on it, with your place of burial, your cemetery, your crematorium, wherever that place is going to be for you. And the only bit of detail that they're going to have to stick in there is the date of your death. So go ahead, prepare one of them. Why not? Save someone the hassle. It's going to be a good experience. It's going to be an experience that hits you in the face. It's going to be an experience that gets you to think, makes you realize, this is what I'm battling with. The thing is, disease, decay and death are not the only things that the Buddha talked about. Because now that you're born, now that you and I are born, we can't do anything to stop it. There's nothing that you can do to stop decay. There's nothing that you can do to stop falling ill. There's nothing that you can do to die, to stop death and old age. So when the Buddha talks about the Arya Satya, the noble truths, he's not necessarily just talking about, hey, this is going to happen to you in this birth. How are you going to fix it? Because, well, it's too late for that. It's too late. If you've built a house, that house is going to fall one day. Brick by brick, that house is going to fall. But what if you stop building? Likewise, the Buddha's teaching is not to try and find a place where you can run and hide when the tsunamis come in. That's not what he tries to teach you. That's not his teaching. His teaching is, it was our mistake in the first place having built this house, having built this cage for us, for ourselves. What, you think it's not a cage? This thing that you call a body, head to toe, is it not a cage? Think about it. What is a cage? A cage is somewhere you trap an animal. You ask an animal, do you like to live inside a cage? Do you think the animal is going to say yes? Is this why when you leave the door open, your pet cat, your pet dog, your pet rabbit runs out the moment it finds an opportunity to escape? No, well, it's a cage. You cage animals in it. You trap animals in it. That's why it's called a cage. Well, what about the cage that you're in right now? This cage that you call a body. Do you really like the eyes that you've got? The head that you've got? The face that you've got? the arms and the legs that you've got, the stomach that you've got? Do you really like it? From head to toe, is there one part that you can point and say, hey, I really like this? Is it your eyes that you like, or is it looking that you like? Is it your ears that you like, or is it hearing, listening to things that you like? What if you are able to look and not have to bother with eyes? Think about all the things that you have to do to protect your eyes. Some people wear glasses when their eyes stop working or go wrong. Some people have to use eye drops, go to the doctor, the optician, get themselves checked. Then you have to eat all kinds of food to make sure you get all the nourishment and the nutrients to keep your eyesight. Then you have to protect your eyes from all kinds of diseases. There's bacteria and there's funguses and viruses that are always on the lookout to attack you. All this because you've got an organ that is susceptible to disease and decay and death. And then despite whatever you do, old age is always whacking at your eyes. Moment after moment. Tell me, or think about this at least if you can't speak with me right now. When did your eyes start to age? Is it when you hit the age of 50? Was it when you hit the age of 30? Or was it 20? Was it 10? Was it 5? Or was it the moment that you came into your mother's stomach? When you were that little embryo and these little things called organs, and they were, and just the moment when they started to, were able to be distinguished as eyes, start to come into being, was that not the moment when your eyes start to die? And yet, why do we celebrate birthdays? Is it birthdays that we really should be celebrating, or death days instead? Every day that passes, every moment that passes, every year, every month, and every week, what are we nearing to? We're nearing to death. In fact, here's something I want you to think about. Think about, say you were buying a house. You're buying a house and you've initiated the process. Or actually, let's think bigger. Let's think grand. Let's say NASA is looking to put a spaceship onto Mars. Forget about houses. Who thinks about houses? Let's think about space and space travel. NASA is looking to put a space shuttle into space because it wants the space shuttle to go and land on Mars and find out and all these interesting things that people want to find out about Mars. And they realize that this project is 10 years long. So they start working on it. They're looking forward to the day when they're going to be able to launch the rocket. And they're looking forward to the day when this rocket is going to land on Mars, and when it's going to go about its business and do all the exploratory work that it's going to be doing when it gets there. So it's that end day that they're looking forward to, the result of all their hard work, the day when their achievements are going to bear fruit. So if this project is 10 years long, do you think they're going to party harder when the first year elapses, or when the fifth year elapses? It's on the fifth year. Why? Because they are 5 years closer to their target. They're going to party harder than the fifth year, when it's actually the sixth year, and the seventh year, and the eighth year. Because they know this day is just coming. It's just round the corner now. We're almost there. We can do this. And when the tenth year comes, just before they launch, that's going to be a big grand party, like no party they've ever seen before. That's going to be the biggest party that they've ever had, they've ever seen. All the employees are going to be invited. But yet with life, we seem to be doing a completely different, we seem to be going about this the wrong way. We seem to be celebrating death. Well, we're celebrating birth, but actually, all that's happening is we are getting 1 year closer to death. We're partying hard, we're partying loud, we're inviting all our friends and family to do what? To tell the world, hey, I'm 1 year closer to death. Party! But that's not what we think we're doing. We think we are celebrating birth. Or I've been alive in this planet for 20 years now. How cool is that? I've been alive for 30 years now. I've been alive for 40 years now. How cool is that? You see, why do you think we do this? The reason we do this, and the reason that NASA celebrates the other way around, is because NASA knows when the rocket is going to be hitting Mars. It's got a date. It knows when this date comes, when that date is the date that they've got circled on their calendar, their rocket's going to launch. The problem with us people, our human beings, is that we don't know what that date is. Do you think if people knew when they were going to die, they would celebrate their birthdays? Do you really think so? If when the mother gives birth to the child, and the doctor comes and says, hey, your child's going to die in 50 years from now, 40 years from now, 30, 20, 10, 5, 4, or maybe just next year, do you think the mother's going to throw a big grand party? All she can think of is, my child's going to die in 10, 20, 30, 40 or 50 years from now. So it just seems that the only problem we are suffering from here, the only reason that we seem to be celebrating birthdays, is because we don't know when we are going. But tell me, is that day not coming? With every passing moment, that day is coming. And yet we seem to be celebrating, we seem to be hoo-haing birthdays. That's something to think about. This is not me telling you off for celebrating a birthday, or telling you you shouldn't be celebrating birthdays or not having birthday parties from here on. That's not my business. That's your business. What you decide to do with your life, what you decide to do with your money, what you decide to do with your friends and your time is entirely up to you. What I decide to do with my time, with my life, with, well, I've got no money now, with the time that I have left alive, is entirely up to me. And that decision I have made very firmly. There's no room for error, there's no room for mistakes. I have one path, I have one destination, I have one journey. And that journey is what I fulfill day in, day out. I don't celebrate a birthday because, as far as I'm concerned, today is my last day. I often tell our novice monks in the monastery, when you wake up, remind yourselves and tell yourselves, today is my last day. Today I will die. I speak to our monks and I advise them, I instruct them, do this. Okay, sorry about the interruption there. We had a power cut. And I hope you can hear us again. We have resumed the stream. That was quite remarkable that we had a power cut when actually we were just talking about death. That power cut didn't come with warning. There wasn't a timetable that we were informed of that said at 3:45 Sri Lanka time you're going to have a power cut. There was no warning. We were just talking away. We were just discussing. We were just living life. And then out of the blue, just from nowhere, came a power cut. Not what I wanted, not what you wanted, not what anybody wanted. But that is the reality. That is the nature of this. This whole system is flawed. This whole system is wretched. This whole system is just entirely a source for suffering. This is why we've got to put a stop to this. This is why we've got to put an end to this. We don't know when the time's going to come for your power cut. We don't know when the time's going to come for my power cut. And before that power cut comes, we've got to do something. And that something is what we should spend time talking about. From the moment we are alive, or from the moment we are born, to the moment we die, we like to say that we are living. It's interesting that we think that, and we tell ourselves that I am living, and you are living, or you're alive, and he's alive, and she's alive. They are alive, we are all living. Did we take a moment, or should we not take a moment to just ask ourselves, what do we mean by this? What is living? What is it to be alive? When you say that I'm living, I'm alive, I'm yet to have my power cut, at that moment, what do you think you're doing? If you think about it, there's only one of few things that we're really doing. Now, yes, one could say, well, I'm eating and I'm sleeping and I'm thinking and I'm watching TV and I'm going to the park, I'm going for a walk, I'm walking my dog and I'm taking a wash. I'm taking pictures and I'm taking my selfies or I'm preparing my obituary notice. It could be any of those things. But if you boil it down to the most fundamental things that we do, and as human beings and as devas and brahmas, bear in mind they're all listening to this. Well, we invited them at the start, so this is a question to all of you. What is it that you do when you think you're living? If we boil it down, as I say, to the most fundamental basic things that we do when we say we are living, think for a moment whether it's anything more than looking or seeing, listening or hearing, tasting, smelling, feeling, or thinking. Do we do anything more than this? We use our five senses, our eyes to see, our ears to hear, our nose to smell, our tongue to taste, our body to feel, and our mind to think. What else do we think we're doing? Is there anything else that we do that we could say, well, actually, there's this as well that I'm doing when I'm alive? Or is it just a combination of the above six things? In fact, through your eyes and ears and nose and tongue and body, you receive sensations which go through this funnel into your mind, which are then processed, and you have thoughts. Thoughts that are associated with seeing or consciousness, eye consciousness or chakku vijnana, sota vijnana or ear consciousness, and so on. We don't need to go that far, we don't need to go that deep. Let's just think about this at a basic level so we can all understand what we're talking about here. I appreciate, and from the feedback we've been getting, people do appreciate that sometimes we talk some deep and profound concepts, but I do understand that we have some very young listeners as well. This is why from time to time I try to there's nothing else we need to talk about other than Dhamma, and this is the Buddha Dhamma we need to talk about. Nothing else other than Anicca Dukkha Anatta. Nothing other than the Four Noble Truths. Nothing other than Paticchasamuppada, dependent origination. Nothing other than that. But even these things, we can keep it simple. So, to all our listeners out there, do we do anything else other than looking, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, or thinking? Anything else? If you think we do, then I'd like to know what that is. The Buddha makes it very clear that these are the six things that a being does when they say that they are living. The process of living, and I make emphasis on the word process of, and I'll come back to that in a moment, is about using eyes and ears and the nose and tongue and body and the mind to take in Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, or give rise to these aggregates, the five aggregates, and process them, to do things with them, to manipulate them, in order to process and generate a world that we produce in our own minds. Now, if you've been listening to our recent sermons, then you'll know that when we talk about the world, we're not talking about the world that's out there. It's not the world that you see when you open your front door and see your garden, and you see your cat chasing a rat and the dog chasing the cat. That's not the world we're talking about. We're talking about the world that exists within our minds. Remember, this is the world that we referred to when we said, and we quoted the Buddha when he says, Dukkho Loke Patittita. The world is placed on Dukkha. So that world does not exist out there. That world exists in our mind. So that's just a reminder. So when in the process of creating this world, we use the five senses and the mind. The inputs we take from the five senses are funneled into the mind and processed. Now, as I said, I made emphasis on the word process because I want you to think, what is living? What is living life other than the process of taking these inputs and then manipulating them within your mind? I'll use a few examples or metaphors, and you can try and relate these metaphors to what we're just talking about here. Now, recently I had a chat with one of our monks in the monastery, and we were talking about a printer and how we use a printer to do, well, one of several things. If you're thinking of a multifunctional printer can do lots of things. It can scan, it can print, it can send faxes, it can send emails. Let's take a printer that can scan and fax and email and print. When this printer is scanning, we can point at the printer and say that printer is scanning. When this printer is faxing a document, I can point at the finger and say that printer is faxing. When this printer is printing, I can point my finger at the printer and go, that machine over there is printing. But the moment that it completes that process and is just a printer doing nothing, just consuming energy, well, when it's consuming energy, I can point my finger and say, there's a machine that's consuming energy. When I point my finger at a machine and say it's doing something at this moment in time, what's happening is actually there's a process that's running within it. So if I take the process of printing, there are several things that help that process run. You've got the machinery, you've got the wheels and the cogs that turn, that take the paper in from the in tray. It sends this paper around the drum. Imagine a toner, a laser printer, and you've got the toner that is heated up and then it prints on the paper, and then you've got the output, which is the printed paper. So you've got the paper, you've got the printer, and by the printer I mean the machinery that, you know, it's all of it, the nails and the screws and the and all the bits and pieces inside the printer, and then you've got the toner. So when these things work together to produce a predefined output, at the moment that this procedure is running, I say it's printing. And if I take the process of scanning, again you've got this light that moves from left to right, you've got the bed on which you place your paper or the document you want to scan, then you've got the flap that you you fold so your paper doesn't move around. And so when it's doing the process of moving that light, which takes an image of the content on that sheet, when it's actually doing that thing, that process, that procedure, I can point at it and go, it's printing. But as soon as that process has come to an end, I cannot point at the printer and say it's printing. Well, when it's not printing, I can't say it's printing. It's just a printer, it's not a printing. I can't point at something and go, it's a printing, it's a scanning, it's a faxing. Yeah, that's just pointless. I can say that's a printer, that's a scanner, that's a fax machine, right? Likewise, when I point at a human being and I say that human being is living, it's got to be one of those six things that's happening. Because if none of those six things are happening, what I'm pointing at is a dead person. Someone that whose picture went on an obituary notice. So when I point at a person that's got a head and arms and legs and a body and eyes and nose and a ear and a tongue and a mouth and all the rest of it, I can say that you're breathing, you're seeing, you're hearing. I mean, what is breathing? Breathing is ultimately you're feeling breath coming in. So it's using the body to take in the sensation of touch. And then the mind processing those sensations and sending signals to your brain to do certain things within your body. Okay? Now, if you take the most basic being, let's say a bacterium will also be doing at least one of those things. A bacterium may not be able to see. There are photosynthesizing bacteria. So those bacteria can be sensitive to light, for instance. Now, one could say, well, that isn't that seeing as well? I mean, yes, obviously you're not going to get an image, but that being is sensitive to light. Well, what else is our eyes doing? It's just sensitive to light, and it's sensitive to colors. Okay, so at a very basic level, the bacterium is doing the same thing. So no matter what kind of being you take, tiny microscopic beings to massive beasts that take up a lot of room in the ocean, all of these beings, including us, you listening to this sermon, if you point at yourself and say, I am living, what you're doing is either seeing or hearing or tasting or smelling or feeling or thinking. If you're not doing any of those things, well, you're dead. So, when I point at myself and say, I or me, you're just pointing at a machine. You're pointing at a machine that is seeing, that is hearing, that is looking or tasting or feeling or thinking. You're just pointing at a machine. And the things that are used to help run that process, you say, are mine. If you go back to the case of the printer, I can point at the printer and I can say, that's the toner, that's the paper, that's the cartridge, that's the in tray, that's the out tray. I'm pointing at the bits that I can touch and I can point at and I can feel and I can see that help run the printing process. Likewise, if you can use your finger, your index finger, and point at yourself, you're simply pointing at, or you're touching the bits that help you run the process. If you're touching your eye right now, go ahead and do it. If you're touching your eye right now, all you're doing is you're pointing at a bit that helps run that process, the process of seeing. It's not the entire bit, it's just one bit of the process. It's just one thing that helps run the process. So if this entire body, head to toe, is just bits that help you run multiple processes. And remember, you can't look when you're smelling. I mean, you can't see when you're smelling. What I mean by that is, you can't be seeing and smelling at the same time. You can't be tasting and feeling at the same time. Now, you might think, well, of course I'm doing that. When I slice my pizza up and I'm ready to shove it in my mouth, I'm smelling it and I'm tasting it and I'm looking at it and I'm slavering at the same time. The reason that we feel that we're doing it at the same time is because the thoughts that are involved in running these processes run at a fraction of a billionth of a second. And so to you and I, it feels like it's just one non-stop process. Going back to the multifunctional printer, your printer is not scanning and printing and emailing and faxing at the same time. No, it's not. It's doing one thing at one given time. Your computer is the same. It's doing one thing at one time. It's not multitasking. Particularly beings, human beings, devas, brahmas, bacteria to whales, none of these animals, none of these beings are multitasking. They're all doing one thing at one time. And that's either looking or seeing, that's hearing, that's tasting, that's smelling, that feeling, or it's thinking. Okay? What generally happens is when you see something and there are some thoughts that are involved in the process of seeing, immediately after that you have about a billion thoughts that are involved with the process of thinking. And then you again open your ear to something and you are listening to something. A few thoughts pass by and then you have about another billion that run with thinking, because it's your thinking that helps you to process the objects that you've received through your eyes and your ears. So your five senses are just the gates that bring information from the world. It's the data actually that comes in from the world. Information is processed within inside. For those of you who've studied computer systems, you will have learned there's a difference between data and information. And likewise, our senses only bring us data. We create the information within ourselves depending on why we do that and what we need and what we expect from that. So I could come and give you a number, I could go to the next person and give them a number, and the third person and give them the same number. To each of you, it's going to mean a different thing. For someone that's studying geology, I give them a number, he's going to think, is that the circumference of the earth? I give them a really big number. Is that the circumference of the earth, or perhaps the diameter of a planet, maybe? I give the same number to a biologist. He's going to be thinking, oh, is that the length of 10 whales side by side? Is that what it is? And I give the same number to a microbiologist, and he's going to ask me, is that the number of bacteria that's in this square inch? So the same number is just data, but information is different because we're all processing it in different ways. So likewise, your eyes and ears and your five senses bring in data, you produce information depending on those. Remember, we talked about the pentagons that exist in your mind. These pentagons surface soon after you've had an input from your five senses. These pentagons surface and These are pentagons. Why? Because it's got five sides. And the thought that you, the sight you've just seen, the smell that you've just had, the sound that you've just received, takes up one of these boxes. It goes into the Rupa, Rupa, Shabda Rupa, Gandha Rupa, Rasa Rupa, or Pottabha Rupa. Remember, Rupa is material form, and material form can be one of six. It could either be the object that you, the material form that you see, or the material form you hear, you smell, you taste, and so on. And as soon as you've received that, you've got one of the five that has now been occupied, and your mind's thirsty, and it's hungry to fill the remaining four, and therefore it gets into action. This is where sankhara comes in. The process of sankhara kicks in because you're suffering from ignorance. To our young listeners, sorry, we are slowly but gradually moving into the profound, deep Dhamma territory. I'll try and move back out of it as soon as I've explained this concept. Because it's interesting to think about who is this I or this me that we keep talking about. Because if it's not one of these six things, what is the me and the I that I'm talking about? Where is this I? Where is this me? When I say I'm watching TV, what am I doing? I'm using my eyes to see something, and I'm using my ears to hear the noises that come from the TV set and the images that come from the TV. I'm looking at, so I'm seeing it. So when I say I'm watching TV, I'm living watching TV. Well, your living is simply using your eyes and your ears and your mind to take in inputs through the first two and then process it with the third. So just going back to the printer again, when the printer is not printing, you can't point at it and go, you're printing, or it's printing. When it's not scanning, you can't point at it and go, it's scanning. It's just a scanner. It's just a printer. Likewise, when you look at a person with the body of a human being, for you to be able to say it's living, it's got to be doing one of those six things. Because if it's not doing one of those six things, it's just a body. And that body should not be at home. If it is, it should probably be in the mortuary, because it's dead. If that body is not doing one of those six things, it's a dead body. It's not a living body. It's a dead body. So the difference between a dead body and a living body, if living is one of those six things, the difference between a dead body and a living body is a living body does one of those six things and a dead body does not do that. Now, if that is the case, then why are we so keen on naming individuals? What is the big deal about calling someone Adam or Smith or John or Cindy or Samantha or whatever the case might be? It's just a printer. It's just a machine that's running a process. The machine doesn't know it's running a process. The process doesn't know it's being run in a machine. Does the printer know that it's printing? No, it's just printing. It doesn't know it's printing. Does printing know that it's being done by a printer? No, it's just cause and effect. Paricchasamuppada, it's just cause and effect. Likewise, a human body, or the physical form of the human body, has no idea that it's living. The process of living has no idea that it's living, that this process of living is happening inside a body. It's avidya, or ignorance, that puts the two together and comes to the conclusion, I am alive, he is alive, she is alive, Samantha's alive, John's alive, Smith's alive, Andy's alive, and they're living. And he's breathing, and he's eating, and sleeping, and drinking, and seeing, and hearing, and tasting, and smelling, and feeling, and touching. Because none of those things are units. It's just a process that's running in a machine. Now, if we can all look at ourselves for a moment and ask ourselves this question. You know, we talked about birth and death a few times today, and the time between these two events. What is it that you and I have been doing since our birth and till the moment we die? Is there anything that we do that is not seeing or hearing or tasting or smelling or feeling or thinking. If it's is it not one of these six things that we do in this between these two events of birth and death? Do we do anything else other than this? And when we do one of these, if when we do one of these things, we point at ourselves and say, I am living. Where does the I come from? Living, yes, I get that. Living is one of these six things. But where's the I am living comes from? Come from? Where does the I come from? Who put the I into living? Where did that come from? You've got a printer that's printing. You point at it and go, it's printing. And the objects or the physical things that help run the printing process are the printer, the toner, the paper, and the cogs and the wheels that are inside it. Now, what if you went to a printer and said, oh, my printer is called Adam. Your friend comes along, he visits you, and you say, hey, can you go and fetch that paper from Adam for me, please? He's going to go, what? Who's Adam? Oh, it's just my printer. You've named your printer? Is what he's going to ask you. Are you crazy? Is he not going to ask you that? He's going to ask you that. Why? Because how have you personified a printer? Likewise, when you look at yourself in the mirror, if you're seeing anything more than the things that help you run one of these six processes, you got to ask yourself, what if your name is? Look at the mirror and go, where is X? Put your name into X. Where's Wally? Look in the mirror and ask, where's Wally? Where is Wally? You know, if your name's Andy, where is Andy? If your name is Sam, where is Sam? If your name is Jacinta, where's Jacinta? Where are these people? Where did they come from? Because all you should be really seeing is just a machine running one of six processes. It's a multifunctional machine. It can see, it can hear, it can taste, it can smell, it can touch or feel the sensation of touch. And it can think. It's just a machine that's running numerous processes. None of these processes run at once. One process at one given time. So if you're not going to name your printer, if you're not going to name your computer, if you're not going to name your phone, why name yourself? Why look in the mirror and go, that is me? Well, where did me come from? Think about this. Because this is the view that we all think is, you know, this is me. I exist. This view that I exist comes from ignorance. And remember, what is ignorance? Not knowing the truth. Not knowing the truth of what? Ignorance of dukkha samudaya, dukkha satya, dukkha samudaya satya, dukkha nirodha satya, dukkha nirodha gamini patibhadarya satya. And if it's ignorance that's responsible for tying this physical body or object that we're looking at in and seeing in the mirror with the processes that are happening within it, and then merging them and saying, that is me, if it's ignorance that's responsible for that, well, what happens for as long as ignorance exists? Dukkha. Suffering. That is the cause for suffering. So to cease suffering, to eradicate suffering, what you should do is obviously eradicate ignorance. As soon as you've eradicated ignorance, me disappears. Why? Because it's ignorance that brought the me in here in the first place. Let me take another example. Right now I'm looking at a tablecloth. I'm looking at a tablecloth. Is there really a tablecloth here? It's just strings kept together ever so closely, and strings running in one direction, strings running in another direction. Now here I'm not talking about a process, but it's just a cloth. It's just strings running in various directions. If I'm pointing at this and going, that's a tablecloth, well, where did that tablecloth come from? It's just string. Or again, if you think about another machine that runs a process, if you think about a robot, right? That's a good example. Think about a robot. These days, robots can do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. As you might have seen on media, there are robots that can talk, there are robots that can walk, there are robots that can fly and do all sorts of things. Now, because you and I know that a robot is artificial, it's not real, even if someone brought a robot to you and said, hey, this is Adam, you're not going to walk up to it and go, hello, Adam. You're not going to treat it the same way like you treat a friend, are you? No, because you know very well that this is just a robot, this is just a machine, and a machine that's running a pre-programmed process. If the robot is able to avoid obstacles and walk from one end of the room to the other, you know very well that what this robot is doing right now is taking in light through its eyes. It's able to distinguish objects by looking at the difference in color and then determine that, hey, I'm looking at one object, I'm looking at another object. I want to get from this end of the room to the other, and if this obstacle stands in between me and the other end of the room, then I need to avoid this. Now, what's it doing right now? It's thinking. So it's just taken in input from the eyes, or from the mechanical eyes, obviously, and then it's using those inputs to run a pre-programmed program in its head. By head, I mean a computer chip. Right? And then when it does that process, it comes to the conclusion, I need to avoid this obstacle, and then walk past it, and then therefore get to the other end of the room. So from the moment you switch on this robot to the moment you switch off this robot, having achieved that objective, having gone that journey, you look at that robot and go, that's just a robot running a program. It's running a process. Why are you and I any different? How can you look at your friend Adam when he's trying to walk from one end of the room to the other, go, that's Adam trying to walk from one end of the room to the other? Where did Adam come from? Where did I or he come from? Is that just, again, not a machine running a process? Running lots of different processes to help it get from one end of the room to the other. The reason I want you to think about it this way is because this helps us to ask ourselves and question our view that a me or an I exist in this world. Because for as long as I think that I exist, my prime objective will be to preserve myself, will be to take care of myself, to make sure that I continue to exist, to make sure that I have all the things that keep me running. Do you think a printer is so keen on printing? Is a printer keen on printing? Does a printer want to keep printing? No. The printer doesn't care whether you use it to print or not. Do you think a faxing machine loves to fax? Do you think a robot loves to walk? No, it doesn't care. It's just a machine. But what about you? What about you? What about you and I? We love to see. We love to hear. We love to taste, and we love to smell, and we love to touch. And we love to think. Why? Because ignorance tells me that I exist. There's a me in this picture that came from nowhere. That came because of ignorance. Because we are unable to distinguish that it's just a machine running these processes. I see a me when I look in the mirror. I see an I when I think about myself and think, hey, what am I doing right now? I'm looking, I'm seeing, I'm smelling, I'm tasting, I'm feeling. Oh, so it must be me that's doing this. So there wasn't a me before, but I've brought in a me through ignorance. Now, if I'm able to eradicate and treat this disease that is ignorance, treat this problem that is ignorance, for every bit of ignorance that disappears, that is chipped away, equal amounts of me and I are chipped away. And what you are left with ultimately is just a machine running processes. Why do you think then an Arahatun Vahanse has no interest in looking, seeing things? He has no interest in hearing things or listening to things. He has no interest in tasting or smelling or feeling things, because there is no ignorance in him. He has come to complete and perfect understanding that is just a machine running six processes. Just like a robot has no interest in looking or smelling or tasting, an Arahatun Vahanse has no interest in looking and tasting and smelling and feeling. But you and I, we love to see, we love to hear, we love to smell, and we love to taste, and we love to do all of those things. Why? Because there's a me that's come into this picture. A me, an I that's come into the picture. Remove the me and the I, you're left with a machine that's running a six processes. Again, I go back to you, think about your car at home. Do you think your car loves to go on trips? Do you think your car loves for the air conditioner to run? Or the indicator lights to be indicating left or right? Do you think your car is just waiting for you to get inside it and slam your foot on the pedal? No, the car doesn't care. What about when the car has an accident? Do you think the car goes into despair? Oh God, look what's happened to me. Do you think the car's like that? No, the car doesn't care. It's just a machine. It's just a machine running, capable of running processes. But obviously, to run the processes, it needs several things. One of which is you. Therefore, you are the driver. You are the car's driver. There's the car's steering wheel, the car's brake pedal, the car's indicator knobs, the car's air conditioner, the car's radio. You've just become the car's driver. The things that help run the process, we say, are the car's X, the printer's X, the human being's X, or my X. Not my ex as in my ex-wife. I'm talking about, when we say it's my eye, my ear, my nose, and my body, and my face. These are the things that help this body and this mind combine and run a process, and nothing else. If you were able to think about this, if when your eyes go bad, you are able to quite easily and without any hassle replace your eye with another eye, would you care so much about your eye? No. You wouldn't care so much about your eyes. You wouldn't care. This is why you don't care so much about your hair. I mean, for those who are not worried about how other people might perceive them. Because they're not worried about their hair. They're now worried about how other people perceive them. That's what they're worried about. So if the question I should be asking them is, if this perception was something that could be replaced just as they like, would you care so much about how other people think about you? Then they would say no. If I walked into an interview dressed like what would you say? Dressed like with hair disheveled, in my pyjamas, right? Let's say I've just woken up, I've got an interview today, I don't brush my teeth, I don't brush my hair, I just walk into an interview. I'm not going to do like that, because I know that that's obviously going to be detrimental. I'm not going to get the job that I want. But if I were able to change that, the way that people perceive me at the touch of a button, at my whim, at my fancy, at the flick of my fingers, I'm not going to worry so much about how people perceive me. Because when I walk into the interview, if people don't like what they're seeing, I flick my fingers and it changes the way I appear. And it changes the way that they view me. So likewise, if I'm able to change the parts of my body just as freely and frequently as I like, I'm not going to worry so much about these things. Likewise, or rather, the only time when you're going to be able to do that is if you are able to look at yourself as a machine. The robot has no worry or has no concern about its fingers, or its arms, or its head. It's not attached to it. Why? Because you can remove one finger and put another finger in. You know, think about a car. The car doesn't care about the wheel. You just take the wheel out and put another wheel in. But the reason that you and I are so concerned and so worried about the things that help you run this process, you know, this is why you love your eyes and you love your body and you love other bits of your body, is because these are the things that help you run that process. So the difference between the robot and yourself is that the robot does not have a me and an I, whereas you and I, we look at the mirror and we go, there's me. Oh, that's me there. You look at a picture and go, oh, that's me there. You know, say, imagine when you used to go to school. Oh, you guys used to go to school, but there'll be others who still go to school, your age. Okay, you got a picture of when you've gone on a trip, a school trip, and you have all your friends standing around. The first person you're looking at is yourself. You scan that picture, where's me, where's me, where's me? It's like, where's Wally, right? You look at, oh, there's me. Where did that me come from? Because all you're really looking at are, if there were 60 of you that went on that trip, there are 60 machines running 6 processes. In fact, they're all looking at the cameraman. So they've got one process that's running. Looking. At who? The cameraman. 60 machines running the same process. Now, where did the me come from? Where did Andy come from? Where did Wally come from? They're just machines running processes. Now if I took a picture of 60 robots, and you know that they're all robots, and if I put that picture in front of you, you're going to say, hey, where's Andy? You're not going to say that, because you know it's a robot. In fact, if someone came to you and said, I've got a pet robot and his name is Andy, doesn't that make you feel just a tiny bit uncomfortable? Have you not felt this? I mean, I've certainly experienced this. When people tell me, oh, here's my phone, and I call it, and they tell me, my phone has a name. That makes me a tiny bit uncomfortable. Why? Because I'm thinking, that's just a machine that's running a process. How can you give it a name? It's, you know, there's a machine, there's a process. It's just the reason that process is running is because it's using the bits of that machine, and there's a pre-programmed process that is running. Why do you even need to name it? It doesn't need a name. Some people name their computers. Some people name their answering machines. Some people name their cups and saucers and their jugs and houses, and people name all sorts of things. Let people name whatever they like. But the point that I'm trying to make here is, when we go to name ourselves, when we go to point ourselves a finger and say, this is me, this is I, you've got to ask yourself, where is the I? I'm just touching at something that helps me either see or hear or smell or feel or think. Well, clearly you can't touch your mind. You can only touch your mind with your mind. But you can't point your finger at your mind, right? But the rest of your body, you can. And all you're pointing at are bits that help you run a process. So, when we started, I talked about the obituary notices that we passed as we came along. These people are now dead. But what about the eye that I'm pointing at right now? If you've raised your finger and you pointed at yourself and said, this is me, and now we know that me is nothing but a machine that is looking or seeing, or a machine that is hearing, a machine that is smelling, or a machine that is tasting, and a machine that is, you know, running one of those things, one of those 6 processes. Where is the me in the next moment? That me that existed at that second is now gone. That me has died. That me is no longer alive. Well, at that rate, I hope that you can comprehend what I'm trying to say here. If you're looking at a machine and saying, there is a printer that's printing. As soon as it's run the print process, you know, let's say for example, let's go back to that printer. You've given the command from your computer to print. Your printer has now started and it's printing. You can hear it printing. You can hear the paper being fed into it. You can hear the toner starting to kick in and so forth. Right? Say you've given the command to run two sheets of print. Okay? You, at the moment you hear the printer warming up and you hear it making a noise, you point your finger at the printer and go, it's printing. And you keep your finger pointed at the printer and you go, it's printing, it's printing, it's printing, it's printing. You just keep saying it. By the way, don't do this when anyone else is around. They're going to be really annoyed. Just keep pointing at the printer and go, it's printing. At one point, it's going to finish printing, but you're continuing to say, it's printing. Can you continue to say that at the moment it stopped printing? No. Now you can't say it's printing. What if someone sends a fax after it's just printed the two pages and you continue to say it's printing? Now there's a fax coming through the line and it's, well, there's a fax that's being received by this printer or this multifunctional device. It's now receiving a fax. Or someone sent another command to scan a document. Now it's scanning, but you're pointing at it and go, it's printing. Well, the printer died a moment ago. Now it's a scanner. Now you have to say it's scanning. Otherwise you're wrong. Are you not? If you're pointing at a machine that's scanning and go, it's printing, you're mistaken. Just the same as if you're pointing at someone that's watching TV and you say, he's watching TV, he's watching TV, he's watching TV, he's watching TV. And then they switch off the television. You can no longer point at that person and go, you're watching TV. Because he's no longer watching TV. Because one of the conditions that gave rise to the creation of this being that is watching a TV has now ceased. Again, we keep going back to causal origination or dependent origination. Remember last week we discussed this. What is watching TV? Watching TV is nothing but a TV being on, your eyes being open, light rays coming from your TV into your eye, and your mind being, your mind being the receptor of these signals that are, or this thought, eye consciousness coming from your eyes. For as long as that process keeps running, you're watching TV. Switch off any one of those things, either your eyes, the TV, pull the plug, okay, or whack this person on the head with a stick. He loses consciousness. The TV is still on. His eyes are still open. He's not watching TV. Switch off the TV. His eyes are still open. He's not watching TV. Or keep the TV on, move something in front of his eyes or close his eyelids. He's not watching TV. So watching TV is nothing but causal dependent origination. Lots of causes that are giving rise to a certain process. Okay? So likewise, living is nothing but lots of conditions, or seeing and hearing and, as we said, living is nothing but all of these, one of these six processes running at any given time. One of these six processes running at any given time, okay? And if we know then that these six processes are nothing but cause and effect, dependent origination, paticca-samuppada, if we know that this is nothing but cause and effect, hetupala, right? Then as soon as one of these causes ceases to exist, then that effect ceases to exist. Just the same as soon as the printer has run out of toner, whether there's paper that's going through the paper, whether the drums are turning, whether the computer sending commands to print or not, has no effect, because one of the important factors for this printer to print has ceased to exist. So you can't then point at the printer and go, it's printing. It's not printing anymore. Why? Because the causes that are required to produce that effect has now ceased to exist. When the causes are there, the effect is there. When the causes cease to exist, the effect ceases to exist. This is cause and effect. Hetupalavadi. This is what you need to see when you look at yourself in the mirror. When you look at yourself in the mirror, at that point in time, you're looking at a machine that is looking. Are you not? Because you're looking at the mirror. You're looking at a machine that is looking. That's the reflection you're seeing in the mirror. But the moment you say, that is me, that is I, you are referring to a moment that passed several billionths of a second ago. And several billionths of a second later, that machine is doing something else. It could be printing, but it's using different sets of courses to give you that effect. So, if that is the case then, what we really need to understand, to kind of summarize what we've been talking about here, is, yes, people die. Conventional death. At 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 and so on. And then we print an obituary notice. But what if we had to print an obituary notice to this person that you call I? You'd have to print an obituary notice every billionth of a second. Every billionth of a second, you'd have to print an obituary notice. Why? Because this thing that you call me or I is nothing but a process that's running. And this process is a seeing process, a hearing process, a tasting process, a smelling process, or a touching process, or a thinking process. And the lifespan of one of these processes is a billionth of a second. Why? Because a thought is the lifespan of a thought is only 17 chittakshana, thought moments. And as soon as 17 thought moments have passed, a thought ceases to exist. And a thought is what helps you see, a thought is what helps you hear, a thought not helps you, but rather a thought is what sees, a thought is what hears. It is the thought that smells, it is the thought that tastes, it is the thought that thinks. And if the lifespan of a thought is one billionth of a second, well, you've got to keep printing jury notices every billionth of a second. I died many billions of seconds ago. I've died now, I died now, I died now, I died now, I died now, I've died now, I've died now and again. Now I'm dead. Again I'm dead now. You wouldn't be able to say anything else other than, I'm dead now, I'm dead now, I'm dead now. When you say, I am dead now, you've died about a billion times. You say, I'm dead now once, you've actually died about a billion times. So then where is I? Where is me? Where are you? You're just a machine that's running six processes. None of these six processes run at once, one process at a time. But because we can't comprehend and we can't grasp the speed of this machine. You know, think again, going back to this printer. Imagine this printer could print 100 pages when you did this. When you flicked your fingers, it could print 100 pages. And then it could scan 600 pages. And then it could receive 10,000 faxes. When you did this, you would just see a multifunctional printer just as spewing papers and receiving tens of thousands of faxes, and your computer getting clogged up with all of these scanned images that are coming in. You wouldn't then be able to say, that's print, you go, that's print, scan, fax, print. You wouldn't know what to call it. You really wouldn't know what to call it. You wouldn't be able to say, that's doing X thing right now. You wouldn't be able to say that. You won't even, and besides, you won't be able to give it a name. Because it's just a machine that's running a process. So likewise, we're all just machines that are running processes. So what makes you think then that your machine that runs these six processes are any better than the next machine? That the machine that's next to you? What makes you feel that you're more valuable than the machine that's next to you that's also running six processes? Why do we think that we are superior to the other person? Why does one person think that they are the same as another person or inferior to another person? The reason we feel this, the reason that we think that we are better than or lower than or the same, and we feel this need and this urge to compare ourselves with somebody else, with another person, is when this me and I come into the picture. This is why Arahatan Vahanse doesn't do that. This is why Arahatan Vahanse doesn't think that he is better than somebody else or lower than somebody else or even equal to somebody else. Because it's just a machine. It's just a machine that's running six processes. How can you say your seeing process is better than my seeing process? How do you know that? If we are both looking at a flower, how can you tell me that your seeing process is better than my seeing process? You can tell me that your eye is better than my eye. Let's say your eye had 20/20 vision and mine doesn't. Well, you could say your eye is better than my eye. But how can you say that your seeing process is better than my seeing process? This machine and this thing that we call me, this thing that we call I, this entity that we call me and I, are just six processes, as we just discussed. If you are able to look at yourself in that view, if you are able to understand what we've just discussed today, then this whole nonsense of comparing myself to somebody else, to my friends and to my brothers and sisters, and thinking, well, I've got a bigger house, you've got a smaller house, and I've got a better car, and you've got a smaller, your car is not as fast as mine, I've got better kids than you, right? All of this comparison goes out the window, goes straight in the bin. Because what are you comparing? Machines and processes. Machines and processes. What you're comparing are seeing processes, hearing processes, thinking processes, smelling processes, and tasting processes. What you should be doing is, hey, my seeing process is better than your seeing process, okay? Oh yeah, well, my hearing process is better than your hearing process. People think you've gone crazy. But have we not gone crazy? We are crazy. We are mad. This is why when there's no me and I, our mad consciousness, vijnani, comes in and creates a me, creates an I, and then it grasps and holds on to the things that help you run that process. Including the I, including the rupa, the object that you see, and including the I consciousness. Because we've given so much value to myself, so therefore I need to exist. Are you ready to die? Are you ready to die? No, you're not ready to die. Why? Because you've given so much value to yourself. You've given so much value to I and to me, to yourself. But where is the yourself here? It's just a machine running a process. When your printer, think about this, when your printer stops printing, when your printer stops working, do you still keep it in your room and say, oh, good printer, I'm not going to throw you away. You were really kind to me. You were really good to me. Whenever I asked you to print, you printed for me. So I'm going to keep you with me. I'm going to wash you and I'm going to wipe you and I'm going to fill your toner. I'm going to pat you every morning. Are you going to do that to the printer? No, you're going to take it and throw it away in the dump. Why? Because it stopped doing this process. So you're treating a machine like that, but what about yourself? If you get a new printer, the old printer just goes in the garbage. Or you give it to somebody else. Or you put it to a side so you can use the new printer. Well, the old printer is still printing. It can still do a job. Why can you not do the same to you, to yourself? If you're just another machine, just like the person next to you, the person next to you is a machine running six processes. You're a machine running six processes. I'm a machine running six processes. Why do I value myself more than I value you? Or the third person there. Why do you value yourself more than you value the other two people? If you do that, then it's the same as you valuing one printer more than the other. When all the difference is, one's newer, the other's older. Because all they're doing is just printing. So, what you need to do then is to reflect on this. Reflect on how and why we seem to find and give rise to this entity called a me and an I, when actually the me that and the I is just a process, and this machine running that process died before I even started saying these words. and by the time I've completed this sentence, I will have died a billion times, over and over. So then therefore, where is the I and the me that I can point and say, that's me? All you're pointing at, all you're seeing in the mirror is just a machine running these processes. If you're seeing anything else, then you've got to realize that that is just a delusional view. That's just delusion. Because what you're seeing there does not exist. What your mind's seeing there does not exist. Your eyes are seeing a machine. Does your eye see a you? Does your eyes see you? No. Your eyes see the machine. Right? Your eyes see your eye. Your eyes see your ears. Your eyes see your nose and your tongue. So your eyes is just seeing. Your eyes are just seeing the machine. So who's seeing the you? Your mind seeing the you. Why is your mind seeing the you? Because your mind is what's suffering from ignorance. So, if you realize then and think about the difference between you and an arahant. And an arahant is someone that does not see a me. He does not see a himself or a he or an I or a you. All he sees is just a machine running six processes. And the difference between an arahant and me, and I even, is that I have ignorance, and whereas he has no ignorance. And because of the lack of ignorance, or because of there being no ignorance, he does not see a you and a me and an I and a him. Then we can infer that it's the ignorance that tells us that I exist, that me exists when I look at the mirror. Think about this. Again, I do apologize for some of our listeners if we went into a territory which can be sometimes a little bit difficult to comprehend. But as I said at the beginning, the reason we need to try and understand this Dhamma is because, you know, we've been going through this process so many times. We have to put a stop to this process. Think about when you went to school. When you went into the first class, if you remember back then, or when you went into, it doesn't matter which class, at the beginning of the year, let's say you went into grade 11, if you can remember that. You went into grade 11, or grade 10 even, you went into that class and you looked at the syllabus. And you thought to yourself, good heavens, how am I ever going to be able to study all of that? How am I ever going to be able to solve all of those sums? How am I ever going to be able to remember all of those things? And work through all those numbers and remember all of that math? I'm never going to be able to do that and do all of those experiments. But you realize that, yes, it's difficult, but what you didn't do is give up. It's hard. It was hard. It was difficult. It was challenging. But today, if you completed that class, if you've been through grade 10, you know today that, well, actually wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Because now you've crossed that. You went through that process. You overcame that challenge. You overcame all of the obstacles that came your way. You didn't give up. So likewise, if sometimes the Dhamma that we talk about, the doctrines and the philosophies and the Buddha's teaching that we talk about can be sometimes complex, it can be profound, but we try our best to simplify it as much as possible. You know, open the Tripitaka and there's no reference to a printer, I guarantee. Open the Tripitaka and there's no reference to a car that likes to honk, or a car that likes to turn left or right, or a printer that likes to print. There's no reference to that. This is why I don't bring a Tripitaka in front of me and read page to page to you. There's no point in doing that. This is why we try and simplify the Dhamma as much as possible and give it in a way that, in a format that is comprehensible to our listeners. At the same time, I recognize and I have to appreciate that there are listeners of all ages listening to this. There are listeners who are very young, from the ages of 6 and 7 to people who are perhaps in their 50s and 60s. So then I have the challenge of how do I make it interesting to a wide range of ages. I can't use the same examples for both, you know, for both age groups, because sometimes, you know, a young child may not be able to understand some of these examples. a child of the age of 6 might not understand when I'm talking about a faxing machine or a scanning machine. Again, you know, it also depends on the culture and the background and what kind of education they've had. So there's all of these factors. But this is why I sometimes say, you know, if at all possible, then please do try to join us in person. Because obviously when you join in person, then I'm able to look at you in the eye. I'm able to observe if you've understood what I've just explained. And then when I feel that you haven't, I repeat those messages and I use different examples. But I can only do that for our listeners who are sat in front of me. So if you ever have the opportunity, then do please visit us, whether that's at the monastery or at, you know, on a Sunday afternoon at Torunakota Pushparamaya, which is in Avissavella, in Sri Lanka. If you have the opportunity, even if you come down for a holiday. I mean, we've got the New Year, Sri Lankan Tamil New Year coming up around the corner. So if you're flying down to Sri Lanka anytime soon, then do come and join us, do visit us. And not just myself, there are other monks who can preach to you in English. And make use of these opportunities. Because whatever you learn, you are then able to go and share with your friends. You can encourage them to listen to these programs. You can share the link out with them, to them. In the past, I've also reminded you of the... there's a magazine called Hela Bodhu Piyuma, in Sinhala, Hela Bodhu Piyuma. They are available in PDF format online. And in those magazines, we publish an article every month, which describes... which details the Buddha's teaching in easy to understand format, hopefully, and it's a series that continues, and every week we build on the previous week. So it's useful if you can grab hold of the old copies and have a look in them. But they're all available in PDF format, so please make use of them whenever possible and available. And also, as I asked you a couple of weeks ago, if any of you have the available time to transliterate these Dhamma sermons, as in type them out, then please let us know, because there's a huge demand for that. There are people who are unable to hear, unfortunately, hard of hearing, and to them, or for them rather, the only mode of communication could possibly be the mode of reading. And so, you know, if we are able to provide them with that, then that is a huge merit. I can't stress enough a deed like that is. You know, it's giving the gift of Dhamma. There is no gift that is greater than the gift of Dhamma. There's no charity that is as rewarding as the gift of Dhamma. So there are plenty of opportunities to do that. And, you know, it's already happening. There are listeners out there who are already doing this. If you want to join them, then please let us know, and we can share those details out with you. Finally, what I want to say is, at the start, you know, we talked about, we did talk quite a bit about death today. One might think, well, why do we always talk about death? It's just death, death, and death. Well, we've got to talk about what the reality is. If, you know, think of again, there was an election in Sri Lanka recently. Before the election happened, or before the day of the election, what do you think people talked about for weeks and months? The election. Why? Because that was such an important thing to their, you know, to their lives. It was the result of that election would be. Well, what do you think is the most important event of your life that's yet to come? Is it your next birthday? No. It's the inevitable. It's your death. Because when that death comes, at that moment in time, you're going to have a thought. You're going to have a series of thoughts, and that series of thoughts will be something that you've done in the past. Something that you've used to do that thing in the past. Or these thoughts will be where you're going to go and be born again after your death. It's only now you have the power to work the causes that can give you the desired effect. Because as you get nearer and closer to that day, that fateful day, the chances of you being able to do something about it are reducing. This is why every day you should actually be embracing death. You should, by embrace I mean you should reflect and you should realize that death is coming. You know, if there's a tsunami that's going to hit us in a month's time, what do you think we'll be talking about? We're not going to be talking about whose birthday party am I going to go to this afternoon. We're not going to talk about, oh, what about that degree certificate that I've got to get myself. I'm not going to be talking about, will I get my job in the 2 weeks' time. I'm going to talk about the tsunami that's going to hit me. And it's going to take everything that I own. The problem is, we don't know when that death is coming, which makes it even worse. The weather channel tells me when the tsunami is coming. The weather channel tells me when that gale storm's coming. Sorry, when the hailstorm's coming, when the gale winds are coming, when I'm going to be covered in snow. The weather channel tells me that. But there's no channel that tells me when my death is coming. This is why you've got that obituary notice with the question mark next to when is my death. And the unfortunate reality is that death could be today. That death could be this hour, this minute. But if we live a life like we're not going to be dying, if we live a life like we are deathless, then we are doing ourselves the biggest disservice ever. We are doing ourselves the greatest harm. It's going to be calamitous. Because when it comes, there's no room for argue, there's no room for debate, there's no room for discussion. When death comes, it's time to go whether you like it or not. And the problem is, we have no idea whatsoever when it's going to come. But people live like it's not going to come to them at all. And some people live like, oh, it's going to be a 10, 20, 50, 30, you know, many, many years from now. The same people, you wake up the next morning, you go and knock on their door, and they don't answer the door. You ring them up, hey, what's wrong? No one's ringing, no one's answering. Or their neighbors pick up the phone. Hey, I thought I rang the other guy. Yes, well, we found out this morning he was dead. That day could be today for all of us. This is why, as I said, I instruct our novice monks in the monastery, remind yourselves every morning, today is my last day. Today I am going to die. Because if you think about it then that way, if you embrace death, then you live a life like a man that's going to die. And a man that's going to die, and a man that's ready to die, knows that when death's coming, he's going to be helpless. So whatever preparation he's got to do, he's got to do now. He's got to prepare for that event, he's got to prepare for that fate, he's got to prepare for when he's hit by death. And the only way we can prepare for that is if we practice the Dhamma. This is why we have to expend our life, we have to use our lives, we have to use every moment that we can spare. Actually, no, not every moment we can spare. Every moment that we have alive, we've got to use towards understanding and taking in and absorbing the Dhamma and removing raga, dvesha, moha from our minds. And every moment that we have spare, we can use for other things. In fact, that's how we should be doing. But what do people normally do? They live a life full of raga, dvesha, moha. And any time they have spare, they go to the temple. They spend in the vicinity and in the association of the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. It's completely the wrong way around. This is why I've got to remind you every week, what you're doing is wrong. What you're doing is only going to bring you harm and damage and destruction. Because what's going to happen is, today you listen to this sermon, you think to yourself, you know what, he's right. I'm going to die today. I'm going to listen to all of these sermons today, right now. I'm going to understand this Dhamma and I'm going to become a Sotapanna. You're going to go to school tomorrow. You're going to go to your workplace tomorrow. You're going to go to the market tomorrow. And guess what the world's going to tell you? You're going to switch on the television soon after you've listened to this sermon. You're telling me you're not? Well, you and I might not be, but our listeners, as soon as this sermon's over, you walk to the living room, switch on the television, and the world's right in front of you. The world's telling you, hey, forget about death. We've got this medicine that makes sure that death's not going to come to you for the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. You're going to live a lifelong of luxury and happiness and sensual pleasures. go enjoy life. Life is worth living, is what they're going to tell you. And when they tell you that, you're going to fall for it. You're absolutely going to fall for it. Because that is the association of ignoble people. That is the association of immoral people. And for as long as you do that, destruction awaits. Death awaits. Decay awaits. Disease awaits. And if you want to put a stop to all of those, you have to associate with noble and moral people. Because they will always remind you, hey, that's not reality. Reality is death, decay, old age and death. Death, decay and old age are coming. Do something about it. Because if you don't do something now, you're going to be too late then. This is the same thing I tell my parents. It's the same thing I tell my family. It's the same thing I tell my fellow monks at the monastery. And it's the same thing I'm going to tell the world. Death is coming. Do something now, or you're going to be too late. Okay. We've spent quite a while discussing and talking about and learning the Lord Buddha's Dhamma. It is now time to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by listening to and preaching the Dhamma to all those who are longing for these merits, all those who rejoice in the merits. So let us all do that now. Before we started the sermon, we invited the Devas, the Brahmas, the spirits and demons and our past relations, the dead, to join us wherever they may be, including those beings who may be born in the woeful plains, to at least come along and witness this meritorious deed and rejoice in that, and in the hope that the merits that they acquire by doing so help them be born in the blissful plane. And for those who are in the blissful plane already, this includes the humans and devas and brahmas, may they all receive the merits that we have all acquired by preaching and listening to this sermon. May the merits help them achieve the noble attainments of Sotapanna, Sakurdagami, Anagami and Arahat. May all beings that suffer from old age, disease, decay and death be able to stop these four curses of life by listening to this Dhamma, by receiving these merits. May they be able to understand this Dhamma, to bear this Dhamma and to comprehend this Dhamma in such a way that they are able to eradicate desire, aversion and delusion from their minds and therefore attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May all those beings that helped us make this event a success also receive the merits of this deed. This includes anyone that made available this technology to us, as well as anyone that helped us to get to this place, to give us the shelter that we are all in right now by making available modes of transport, by making available electricity and various other facilities that help us make this event possible. And also, may you all be able to rejoice in these merits. May you all be able to receive these merits. And also, if you've used computers and other devices to listen to this Dhamma, may the creators and founders of all these technologies, the internet, etc., be able to receive these merits. May they all use these merits to be born in the blissful plane. And once born in the blissful plane, may they all be able to be endued with the faculty of wisdom such that in receipt of this Dhamma, they're able to understand this Dhamma and attain the noble fruits of Sotapanna, Sakurdagami, Anagami and Arahat. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from the clutches of samsara. May all beings attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Theruvan Sarnayan.